No, Obituary of Ethel Merstead.
Oh, okay.
OBE. You know, they wrote a book on her from the, called The Women's Work. I remember they were writing to me, asking if I had any more information, because this Gurdjieff, she was with Gurdjieff in Europe for some years.
Oh, I see.
So, so I guess she has some history there.
Yeah.
And they, some followers of Gurdjieff organization, they wrote a book about her.
Hmm. She was with Gurdjieff before she came to
Europe. Yeah,
yeah. She's what?
This Gurdjieff, European, my guru. You heard
I've
of her?
I've heard of her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But said, with Ethel Merstead, another of the senior devotees who were here in Bhagavan's lifetime, beginning in the late 1930s, she used to spend the cool month of every year here, traveling for the rest of the year. She was always a great traveler. It was only in 1959 that she built herself a house and settled down here permanently. Even that was a remarkable feat, characteristic of her terrific drive and energy to build a house, supervising every detail at the age of 77 without speaking the language.
Wow.
She had a long and active life. It was for her services and the relief work in Belgium after the First World War that she was awarded the OBE, Order British Empire. Before coming here, she was with Gurdjieff at Fontainebleau for some years. She was a follower of Gandhi, and under his influence, adopted a village in North India, where she ran a free dispensary, and unofficially settled disputes and did all she could for the villagers. She spoke Hindi, but not Tamil. Nevertheless, out of the devotion to Bhagavan, it was here that she finally chose to settle. Shortly after building her house, Ethel Merstead fell ill. She was mentally as alert and active as ever, but she was not able to go out, even to walk a few hundred yards to the ashram, and she was too independent in spirit to consent to a wheelchair. She still carried on a wide correspondence, and many people came to see her. 3 years ago, she was taken to Madras for a medical checkup, and the doctor told her that she had only 6 months more to live. Perhaps few people would have gone on longer in her state, but her tremendous vitality carried her on. She recognized and freely admitted that her long illness was a sign of grace, forcing her to be more indrawn, have a more indrawn life when she was had always been too extrovert. When the end came, it was one more relapse, of which there had been several. Her strength failed her, and she died peacefully, with no struggle, in the afternoon of March 19th at the age of 85. Yugo Meyer, Ganesh, and Matagi were by her bed when she breathed her last. This is introducing S.S. Cohen. S.S. Cohen, Jewish by race, now they call it a race, not religion. Mm-hmm. And Paul used to think it's a race also. Judaism.
Yeah.
Iraqi by origin, accountant by profession, came to India in his early youth, about 25 years ago, took Indian citizenship and settled down here for life. Even at that young age, he felt that it was in India that he would find the key to life's mystery. He had read some Buddhist books in Iraq. He worked professionally in Bombay for a few years, then joined the Theosophical Society and went to live at its headquarters in Adyar, Madras, to study, meditate, and serve. He stayed here for 5 years, delving oh, it should have been there, delving into Buddhist, Vedantic, and Theosophical literature. However, Mr. Cohen is a man of exceptionally shrewd mind and keen wit, and not a person to take anything on trust. Gradually he came to the conclusion that, although he had learned much philosophy, he had not set foot on a path leading either to higher powers, which he still valued at that time, or to a higher state of being. Back again, he went to Bombay for professional work. He was with, you know, Sri Krishnamurti for some years also. He used to travel with him and everything. But he came to Ramanashram in 1936. His next attempt was on hearing of the Maharshi. While he was living in Madras, he never heard of Bhagavan. He was living at the Adya, so he never heard. Again, he threw up his work and set forth on the quest. And this time, he found the guidance he sought. He went to Sri Ramanashram with the intention of staying 14 days and stayed 14 years from 1936 until the Maharshi shed the body in 1950. Thus, with Major Chadwick, Paul Brunton, and Sujata Sen, she was a French doctor, and David McIver, he was a member of the original European colony here.
My goodness, wow.
Now there's hundreds, right?
Yeah.
Or thousands, I hope. Like a member of others, he did not think of writing about the Maharshi during his lifetime. It was only some years after, 1950, that he wrote Guru Ramana, a book showing keen observation and great devotion, of which the third edition is now being printed. Have you read that book?
Guru Ramana.
Guru Ramana.
No.
Very good. You must have read it as a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not completely with pieces.
Another book of his, published by the Ashram, Reflection on Talks with Sri Ramana Maharshi, this is a commentary giving his views on several important points from the large volume of Talks with Sri Ramana Maharshi compiled by Swami Ramananda Saraswati, for whom see our January 1964 issue. He also published a condensed translation of Srimad Bhagavatam, reviewed in art. And he also, this Advaita Sadhana, published by someone else. Nice book. It's mostly for these Westerners that come to Ramanashram and don't know anything.
Yeah.
And it gives guidance, you know, how to benefit most by a visit to Ramanashram and the teachings of the Mundaka Upanishad. And another one he wrote also, another small one. Mr. Cohen still remained at Tiruvannamalai for some years after the Mahanirvana of the Maharshi, and he remained a firm supporter of the Ashram authorities at a time when many wavered. After a few years, however, he retired to a quiet life in Vellore, a town situated 3 hours bus or train journey to the north. He has remained there ever since, keeping in touch with the Ashram by correspondence and occasional visits. For a Ramana Janti issue in January 1966, he contributed an article entitled Ramana Sadguru. Mr. Cohen is lively and very witty conversationalist. He is very simple in his way of living. He has a wide knowledge of Bhagavan's teachings and enormous devotion to him. Not a few devotees have benefited from talks with him. He moved into the ashram maybe the last 5 years of his life. I met him in the ashram in the 80s. He died 82, so in the 70s and the 80s. From the early days, in our book review section of October 1965, we published an appreciative account of the scattered writings of Swami Omkar. His ashram, Shanti Ashram, Totaperli Hills, and AP was Andhra Pradesh. He has now sent us a cutting from his monthly magazine piece dated September 1931, describing the first visit here of Paul Burton, whose book, A Search in Secret India, did more than anything else in the early days to make Sri Bhagavan widely known. When Paul Burton first came here, he was using the name Hearst. Paul Burton was his pen name, Raphael Hearst. It's a Jewish, I think it was Jewish, right? Raphael Hearst.
I don't know.
Raphael wouldn't be, right?
No, I don't think so.
He later adopted it as his permanent name because the book he wrote under it brought him fame and made him widely known, owing to his account of Sri Bhagavan. Now, he sold the rights of it for not very much. And then it was published in many languages and all around the world it was circulated. But that started off his actual book writing career.
Yeah.
He worked as a journalist in England for some time.
They needed a search in secret Egypt.
Yeah,
he had
the Himalayas, the secret of the Himalayas, all the kinds of books. You know. This is the only good one, I think. Well, he was sincere when he was going around, but then that started his writing profession. So he went around. You read the book, Christine? A Search in Secret India?
No, I haven't.
No, he goes around to all these Mahatmas and well-known...
It's a very interesting book.
Like a novel.
Yeah.
It reads like a novel.
Wow, I'd like to read it.
And you read that in Yogananda, you know, Autobiography of the Yogi, he was a big fan of Paul Brunton.
Uh-huh.
You can tell because I saw him shaking his hand in the movie twice.
Right.
And then I realized he fashioned his book under the same formula as Paul Brunton.
Oh.
He went around and visited all those Mahatmas and everything Paul Brunton visited, and he wrote about it in his book.
Okay.
But Yogananda had a more personal, better, you know, he was a yogi, had a personal story.
Yeah.
When Paul Brunton was just a journalist or something else. So Yogananda could write a better book. But he went around, even visited Bhagavan, Yogananda.
I think I've read excerpts or part of
it
because his name rings bells. Yeah. Like it's from the
ashram.
So.
And it's interesting to note that
he fell out with the ashram, didn't
what?
He? Didn't he fall out with the ashram?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. Bhakta Bhagavat, the founder of this ashram, first read his book. That's how he heard about Bhagavat, 1941, but in Hindi. Mm. It was translated into the Hindi version.
Oh.
It is interesting to note what an event a visit from a foreign journalist to the ashram was in those days, far off days, something to be written about in the newspapers, you know, around 1930 or so. It was 4:30 in the afternoon and the disciples were sitting before the Maharshi in the hall. And we're talking about a notification that had appeared in the dailies to the effect that a Mr. Hearst and a Buddhist bhikshu were intending to visit the ashram. Now that bhikshu was a foreigner also, European. The clock struck 5 and there entered the hall a man in European costume bearing a plate of sweets and followed by a Buddhist monk. The visitors offered the sweets to the Maharshi and then, after making obeisance in the Eastern way, they both squatted on the floor before him. These were the visitors of whom the disciples had been talking. The man in English clothes was R. Raphael Hearst, a London journalist who was then on a visit to India. He was keenly interested in the spiritual teaching of the East and thought that by an intelligent study and appreciation of it, the cause of cooperation between East and West might be greatly promoted. He came to Raman Ashramam after visiting many other ashrams. The bhikshu who came with him is also an Englishman by birth. He was formerly a military officer, but is now known as Swami Pragyanananda. He is the founder of the English ashram Rangoon, both visitors sat spellbound before Maharshi, and there was pin drop silence. The silence was broken by the person who had brought the visitors asking them if they would like to ask any questions. They were, however, not in a mood to do so, and thus an hour and a half passed. Mr. Hurst then stated the purpose of his visit. In a voice of intense earnestness, he said that he had come to India for spiritual enlightenment. Not only myself, he added, but many others also in the West are longing for the light from the East. The Maharshi sat completely enthralled and paid no attention. One of those who were sitting there asked them if they had come to the East for a study of comparative religions. No, the Bhikshu replied. We could get that better in Europe. We want to find truth. We want the light. Can we know truth? Is it possible to get enlightenment? The Maharshi still remained silent and enthralled. And as the visitors wanted to take a walk, the conversation ended and all dispersed. Early the next morning, the visitors entered the hall and put some questions to the Maharshi with great earnestness. The conversation reproduced below is from rough notes taken while it was going on. Bhikshu, we have traveled far and wide in search of enlightenment. How can we get it? Maharshi, through deep inquiry and constant meditation. Hurst, many people do meditate in the West, but show no signs of progress. Maharshi, how do you know that they don't make progress? Spiritual progress is not easily discernible. Hurst, a few years ago, I got some glimpses of the bliss, but in the years that followed, I lost it again. Then last year, I again got it. What is that? Maharshi, you lost it because your meditation had not become natural, sahaja. When you become habitually interned and the enjoyment of spiritual beatitude becomes a normal experience. First, might it be due to the lack of a guru? Maharshi, yes, but the guru is within. That guru who is within is identical with yourself. First, what is a way to God realization? Maharshi, vichara. Ask yourself, who am I? Inquiry into the nature of yourself. Bhikshu, the world is in a state of degeneration. It is getting constantly worse. You know, there's some old Indian scriptures, like 1,000 years old, and they say the same thing. They say, the next generation, all the children and the young people are lost. They say the same thing from generation to generation. It's been going on for 1,000 years. The world is in a state of degeneration. It is getting constantly worse, spiritually, morally, intellectually, in every way. Will a spiritual teacher come and save it from chaos? Maharshi, inevitably, when goodness declines and wrong prevails, he comes to reinstate goodness. The world is neither too good nor too bad. It is a mixture of the two. Unmixed happiness and unmixed sorrow are not found in the world. The world always needs God, and God always comes. Bhikshu, will he be born in the East or the West? Maharshi laughed at the question, but did not answer it.
Oh, that's funny.
Because he's telling you, you've got to be born within you. Hurst, does the Maharshi know whether an avatar already exists in the physical body? What's the next Vishnu avatar?
After
No, it's supposed to be coming.
A horse?
Oh, there's already there. Kalki is there.
Kalki, yeah, he lives in Toronto, I heard.
He's been running. Kalki's been going on for quite some time now, right? Yeah.
Someone told me they visited him in Toronto. He claims to be the next avatar of Vishnu.
It's already been running for thousands of years. Kalki.
Kalki is an age.
Well, it's supposed to be the next incarnation of Vishnu. They have the whole series of incarnations.
Kali is the age, next age. Kali.
After Kalki, Kali.
Dwapara. Treta. Dwapara. Then Kali. Kali is the age.
Kali.
Now.
It's the Kali.
Kali. So, does the Maharshi know whether an avatar already exists in the physical body? Maharshi, he might. First, what is the best way to attain Godhood? Maharshi, self-inquiry leads to self-realization. Hurst, is a guru necessary for spiritual progress? Maharshi, yes. Hurst, is it possible for the guru to help the disciple forward on the path? Maharshi, yes. Hurst, what are the conditions for discipleship? Maharshi, intense desire for realization, earnestness and purity of mind. Hurst, is it necessary to surrender one's life to the guru? Maharshi, yes. One should surrender everything to the dispeller of darkness. One should surrender the ego that binds one to this world. Giving up body consciousness is the true surrender. Hurst, does the guru want to take control of the disciples' worldly affairs also? Maharshi, yes, everything. Hurst, can he give the disciple the spiritual spark he needs? Maharshi, he can give him all that he needs. This can be seen from experience. Hurst, is it necessary to be in physical contact with the guru? And if so, for how long? Maharshi, it depends on the maturity of the disciple. Gunpowder catches fire in an instant, while it takes some time to ignite coal. Hurst, is it possible to develop along the path of the spirit while leading a life of work? Maharshi, there is no conflict between work and wisdom. On the contrary, selfless work paves the way to self-knowledge. Hurst, if a person is engaged in work, it will leave him little time for meditation. Maharshi, it is only spiritual novices who need to set aside a special time for meditation. A more advanced person always enjoys the beatitude whether he is engaged in work or not. While his hands are in society, he can keep his head cool in solitude. Bhikshu, have you heard of Mayur Baba? He went to visit Mayur Baba. Paul Brunt. It's in his book, you know. He wasn't that impressed, right? You read it?
Yes.
Maharshi, yes. Bhikshu, he says that he will become an avatar in a few years.
Oh, really?
He came to the U.S. He's very popular, you know. Even in Hollywood, you know, he went to California. A lot of people are following.
Which place is Mahabhav in India?
I think he's a Sadar, right?
He was Parsi.
He was Parsi, yeah. Even down in Virginia and North Carolina, they had a center. There were followers in the 60s and 70s.
What? I think so, on Virginia Beach. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When I lived in Virginia, mm-hmm. I never went there, but I heard a lot
about it. Bhikshu, he said that he will... Is it Myrtle Beach or... No, Virginia Beach.
It's Virginia Beach kind of merges into Myrtle Beach, but it's the southern part of Virginia, right?
He said that he will become an avatar in a few years. Maharshi, everyone is an avatar of God. The kingdom of heaven is within you, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, Krishna, all are in you. One who knows the truth sees everyone else as a manifestation of God. Bhikshu. Will the Maharshi make a statement about Mayur Baba? Maharshi, what statement? That the existence of an outer avatar is a question which seekers of truth need not consider. What they're most interested in. Bhikshu, will the world be rejuvenated? Maharshi, there is one who governs the world, and it is his business to look after it. He who has created the world knows how to guide it also. Bhikshu, does the world progress now? Maharshi, if we progress, the world progresses. As you are, so is the world. Without understanding the self, what is the use of understanding the world? Without self-knowledge, knowledge of the world is of no use. Dive inwards and find the treasure hidden there. Open your heart and see the world through the eyes of the true self. Tear aside the veils and see the divine majesty of your own self. So here's letters to the editor. Dreams. Ever since I came to know, this is from one D, Shiva Pragasam, and Manipay, Ceylon. Ever since I came to know of Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi, I've been one of his numerous disciples. On the 27th November 1966, before going to bed, I prayed to Lord Ramana thus, Lord, I have been absorbed in what you have told your devotees about self-inquiry. Tonight is the night of Kartikeya Deepam, when the summit of Arunachala will be solemnly lit up. Will you not, out of your infinite grace, appear to me in my dream tonight and initiate me in the mystery of the self? Making an appointment. With this prayer in my heart, I soon fell asleep. Lord Ramana, out of his grace, appeared to me in my dream during the third quarter of the night. The smile on his lips is still fresh in my memory. The scene of the dream was the ashram. He was there, and I too. I followed him wherever he went. Finally, he looked at me graciously for a few seconds and gave me a handful of boiled white rice from some place where it was being distributed. I received it with due reverence, but did not start eating this prasadam until I woke. I had a very pleasant feeling from the dream. Do you consider the dream of mine his initiation or a mere fabrication of my mind? Editor, this was certainly initiation. The rice given was a symbol of spiritual nourishment. Only you should have begun eating it. Gotta go back and eat some.
Back in the dream.
Here's one from Saraz Narasimha Rao. What are dreams and what is their significance? Why do we dream? We experience some incidents in dreams which could never think of in real life. Editor, these are questions rather for an article than a letter. There are different kinds of dreams. The ordinary action of the mind and a significant symbolical dream. Perhaps the first question should be, what is the reality and significance of our supposedly waking experience? Meditation. I am a novice in the practice of meditation and yoga, who wishes to pursue more serious practice and hopes to find instruction and a conducive environment for it. I am addressing this general inquiry to a number of authorities, hoping to get an extensive, varied, and deep idea of the possibilities for guidance and direction in these things. I turned from the study of psychology at Reed College. This is Robert Steward Evanston in Illinois, from Illinois, to philosophy and religion for the last 4 years. Since then, I have pursued on my own the study of Eastern and Western religions and the practice of yoga. I would very much appreciate some information on instruction courses and practices in which you are involved, and any other bits of information, ideas, or direction you feel appropriate, and am open to every point of view, faith, or belief. Editor, it is quite sensible to examine various paths, as you are doing, before deciding on one. But having decided, it is best to stick to one, though there is no harm in reading about others. The path instituted by the Maharshi, and still followed under his guidance, is the simplest and most direct, with no need for ritual or meetings or outer aids. The self-inquiry that he taught is not meditation in the usual sense of the word. As he put it, in meditation you have subject and object, whereas in self-inquiry there is only the subject. Unquote. It is not rational or psychological inquiry. Rather, it means to concentrate on the pure sense of being or of I am, which is the same as pure, undifferentiated consciousness, without thoughts. Whenever thoughts come, dismiss them, ask to whom they came, and thus return to the I to whom thoughts come. This should be practiced regularly, daily, even if only for a short time, for instance, first thing in the morning and last thing at night. Self-Inquiry in Japa by P.T. Murray, Scarborough. Although agreeing that self-inquiry as expounded by Bhagavan is a combination of all paths, I feel drawn to the practice of japa as a preliminary measure, and would be very grateful if you would kindly advise me on this. I understand Bhagavan occasionally recommended mental repetition of I, and I wonder whether the instruction applied to the Tamo form of I, or whether the short English form would be equally effective. Are the repetitions to be made slowly, and should they coincide with exhalation and inhalation? Should one doing so-called brain work attempt to perform japa while at work? I realize that these questions may seem superficial, but they have arisen as a result of efforts, albeit poor ones. Editor, your questions are not at all superficial. The purpose of spiritual practice is to keep the mind calm and prevent ego assertion. So whatever helps to do that is good. The English word I can be used for japa. The repetition helps to keep the mind steady, especially if coordinated with the breathing, and at the same time the meaning of it helps to focus attention on the true I, the self. It is good to keep it up so far as possible as an undercurrent while doing any kind of work, or while walking or riding in a train or bus. This does not conflict with the practice of self-inquiry. Both can be used. Letter from R.J. Hearn, New Westminster, British Columbia, Canada. Suffering. I have just been reading your book, Buddhism and Christianity in the Light of Hinduism. Here's a book he wrote. It's an excellent and has the direct simplicity which always seems to appear when the writer knows who he is. I realize through reading this and various articles on the mountain path, etc., that I have always been an Advaitin at heart, and hence faced east, where such a path is not considered heretical or heretical. Once one lets go and ceases to resist, daily gazing inward, peace seems to come like a cool river which quenches all anguish and makes one what I have heard called in Zen an unconcerned man. I am a male nurse, an assistant charge of an acute ward in a West Canadian psychiatric clinic. So much of the suffering one sees in this field and elsewhere comes of vain attempts to assert a mythical and pitiful, haughty and threadbare separateness. With gratitude for your clear exposition in your writings, and with every good wish to all at the ashram. And then another letter. As I understand it, by Bhim Krishnama Sikandarbhat, as I understand it, Sri Bhagavan said that suffering was sent into the world so that, as a consequence, man would turn his mind inwards and discover his real self. Sri Bhagavan said, God is perfection, and his work is also perfection. Now, what I cannot follow is why a God who is perfect created a man who could be guilty of wrong identification with the body or the ego. Why did God, the all-perfect, not create a perfect and flawless man? Why did he create a perfect and flawless man incapable of getting lost in the morass of confusion? Editor, philosophically, this is a very complicated question and cannot be answered in a few words. There's an article called Good and Evil by Sagittarius, that's him, which indicates the answer is being published in our issue of the coming October. There's one direct road to an answer without philosophy. That is to ask yourself, who am I? And discover who was born, who suffers, who is imperfect, who creates what. He writes under different names. He said there's an article in Next Issue of Sagittarius. That's his, one of his names. If he doesn't find an article written on the topic he wants it to be, and so he writes himself under a different name. The whole Next Issue is on the problem of suffering.
Which year is one of that?
This one I just read is 1966. What I've been reading from now will start January 1977. Anatta by A. Rao. I was walking along the road when I met a fool talking fool talk. There isn't one. How happy I am that there isn't one, he said, as if it was a song he was singing. Isn't one what? I asked. Isn't one me? He said foolishly. And he walked on looking quite happy.